Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. Coming up in just a minute, Naomi Klein and how her book, The Shock Doctrine, which came out a year ago, relates to the financial crisis. The new version is out in paperback. She's working on a Rolling Stone piece for next week called The Next Trough, which is going to get into it. So this is going to be interesting to relate the shock doctrine to the financial crisis. And we do begin today with the author Naomi Klein, who's had a lot to say lately about the financial crisis in the context of her book, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, originally published in hardcover last year, now out in paperback. The basic thesis of The Shock Doctrine, if you don't know it, is that whenever there's a crisis in the world, 9/11 or anything else, private industry uses the shock of the crisis to convince government to privatize public institutions, often with less service to the public as a result. So does this apply to the current shocks we're all experiencing? Naomi Klein joins us now. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you again.
Want to remind us a little more of the basic idea behind the shock doctrine as you conceived of it before the current crisis?
Yeah, well, the book is really an alternative history of how we ended up with this radical form of deregulated capitalism that is imploding so spectacularly as we speak. And the thesis of the book is that we didn't end up with this radical form of deregulation and radical privatization because people desperately wanted it and voted for politicians who were promising it. People vote for politicians who are promising tax cuts, a more populist side of the program. But these policies tend to be pretty unpopular, particularly when it comes to eroding labor standards, environmental standards, and privatizing essential services like healthcare, water, things like that. So it takes a crisis. It takes some form of destabilizing crisis, which can be appealed to push through the unpopular parts of this program. And so it's not just privatization. It's really policies that are really in the interests of corporations, pro-corporate policies.
And your examples range from Halliburton benefiting from Hurricane Katrina to luxury hotels getting to replace coastal fishermen in the South Pacific after the tsunami. And I gather from what you just said about deregulation at the heart of this that you must see shock doctrine capitalism as having helped to cause this current crisis, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing that happens once you embrace these policies is that the system then becomes self-reinforcing. This is a very volatile economic model we've embraced, and it's a boom and bust economic model. So the shocks are really built in. You have boom times, but then you have the shocks, whether it's a currency shock, whether it's the banking sector shock, a debt shock like we're living through right now. But it can also be a price shock. You know, you deregulate commodities, and this particularly affects poor countries that are dependent on a single commodity. Suddenly the price of coffee goes down and a whole country's economy is devastated. So when you're in the casino, you are subject to these shocks.
Then
each one can be harnessed to push through more of the same if we're not careful.
Right. But here's the thing. Do you think that we're really seeing the shock doctrine in action right now, or are we seeing the exact opposite of the shock doctrine in what's in the headlines? The public sector is taking equity in that most private of capitalist institutions, the banks. Is it the shock doctrine in reverse?
You know, I wish it was. I think we have seen some examples of people being very resistant to these tactics, of people identifying these patterns, saying this is exactly what they did after 9/11. They were ready with their Patriot Act, people comparing Paulson's original plan as a kind of economic equivalent of the Patriot Act. You had, Jon Stewart on The Daily Show cutting together Bush's pre-Iraq speech with his give me the $700 billion or we're all going to die speech. And this is how you resist these tactics. The reason why it's possible to push through very unpopular policies in the midst of a shock is because when the ground is moving beneath our feet, we become disoriented, we become fearful, and we will accept accept almost anything that is presented to us in the form of a rescue, of some kind of a bailout. We tend to trust the experts in a moment of crisis. And that really hasn't happened in this case because there's been this pattern recognition of, wait a minute, they've done this before. We don't really trust these guys. So people have stayed more oriented. But, you know, in terms of what you're saying, that this is actually nationalization, the pattern that I'm identifying is pushing through pro-corporate policies in the midst of a crisis. And this pattern of boom and bail capitalism, where in the good times the profits are privatized, but in the bad times the debts are nationalized, the burdens are nationalized, is actually a pattern that I show in the book that's actually been taking place since the very first laboratory for this extreme capitalism, which was Chile in the 70s under Pinochet, where they had this, the first phase was the deregulation of the financial sector and the rise of a group of businesses that were known as the piranhas, which were investment banks that were highly, highly indebted, highly, highly leveraged. Then they had a debt shock in the early 80s when interest rates increased, and the regime responded by nationalizing these banks, but not in the public interest. That's the key. The key question is not, is there state intervention? The question is, whose interests is the state intervention happening in? And I think consistently it's in the interests of multinationals.
Privatize the profits and nationalize the losses,
exactly.
Right? Socialize the losses, spread them around the taxpayer. And yet, what we keep hearing, and what, you know, I don't know if the majority of the public, which originally opposed the bailout bill, has been convinced of this. But of course, you know, we have heard from so many people now that debt relief for the elites is too simple a way to look at it, that we're seeing the disappearance of regular jobs for regular people because credit is frozen so companies can't do business. Have you come around to that point of view at all? I know you opposed the original bailout bill.
Well, first of all, no, I don't think people were arguing that the government should do nothing in the face of this crisis. They were opposing the specifics of the bailout. And let's remember that the original Paulson plan, what people were so opposed to.
The three-page Paulson plan.
Yeah, but even even the second phase of that plan, which they did get through Congress eventually, was primarily focused on buying the so-called toxic debts or the distressed assets of the financial sector and essentially moving the crisis, taking the crisis from Wall Street and moving it to Washington so those debts can detonate, you know, on the public books. And people had a visceral reaction saying this isn't going to work. And what's really interesting is they've been proven right. Right. I mean, there has been an about turn where now, yes, they're still planning to spend hundreds of billions of dollars buying those toxic debts. But the economics profession has overwhelmingly said this is a bad idea. And the Gordon Brown model and the European model of buying equity in the banks, a direct injection to encourage lending, to address the issues that you're bringing up, job loss, the fact that the credit crunch, is a much better model. And that forced Paulson and Bush to change the plan and go partially to this equity model. So now they're saying they're going to spend $250 billion of that $700 billion buying equity. So what's interesting is the public actually has been proven right. You know, there was so much condescension about, oh, those angry Main Streeters just wanting to punish the bankers. But in fact, it turns out that original sort of visceral no that people heard and that changed the votes of some key Congress people in the first round was actually a better vote. And we're just very lucky that there was a little clause negotiated in that bailout that has allowed them to buy the equity in the banks. Still, and this is really important, this is a bad deal. The deal that was negotiated by Paulson with the nine big banks.
You think it's still a bad deal?
Well, I mean, not just me. The Financial Times thinks it's a bad deal.
And because?
Because if we compare it to what Gordon Brown did 5 days earlier, I mean, 5 days earlier, Gordon Brown negotiated the benchmark for what you can get out of banks in exchange for buying equity.
So you think it's still so different?
It's very different. Gordon Brown negotiated 12% returns for UK taxpayers on their equity investment. He negotiated voting rights, seats on the board, and also, and this is key, he got in writing the fact that the banks had to use this money for what Paulson said the bailout is for, which is addressing the credit crunch, the fact that they need loans for small businesses and they need loans for homeowners. Gordon Brown got that in writing, and the British banks that are taking advantage of this plan, like Lloyd's, are actually having to begin lending again. What's happening in the U.S.? Let's contrast this. 5% returns, no seats on the board, no voting rights, and it turns out that they're just hoping that they spend The first phase is $125 billion. The second phase is another $125 billion. They're just hoping they'll spend it lending. But now the banks have actually said what they plan to spend it on. Okay, Citi is saying they're going to spend it on mergers. Morgan Stanley is spending a chunk of it on bonuses because they're paying out $10 billion in employee salaries this year, including bonuses. They only made $5 billion. So the money is going there, and that's another difference. In Britain, Brown negotiated that they can't be paying shareholders while they're receiving this equity. The taxpayers are the only ones who
are the shareholders.
Exactly. In the U.S., the money's still going to be going out the door to in salaries, bonuses, and to shareholders. So it's a terrible deal, and worse than that, Brian, it's eroding the British deal because now the British banks are turning around, going, "We don't like this deal. Can we renegotiate?"
Huh? And maybe investors' money is flowing into the American banks as a result. I'm glad you brought up voting rights because that really is such a big deal, and it was not one of the things that got a lot of media. I know Henry Paulson said, yes, we need to take an equity stake in the bank, but he didn't want to have the government in the position of telling the banks how to run their businesses. And yet, they've been now wringing their hands over the last few days because despite the equity injection, credit is not flowing once again. We have a few minutes left with Naomi Klein, author of The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism, as we look at the financial crisis in the context of her Shock Doctrine thesis. We just have a few minutes left. I saw you quoted from a recent appearance saying the next Treasury Secretary should not come from Wall Street and that Obama and McCain need to hear this. Where else would a next Treasury Secretary come from?
Well, wouldn't it be great if the next Treasury Secretary was somebody who actually saw this crisis coming as opposed to contributed to its creation, like Henry Paulson? You know, when he was at Goldman Sachs, he was known as Mr. Risk because he was one of the innovators of these complex financial instruments. He took Goldman Sachs's debt from $20 billion in 1999 to $100 billion in 2005, according to Business Week. So when they talk about buying out the toxic debts, he's actually buying up some of his own debts, potentially. I've been saying Joseph Stiglitz, the former senior economist at the World Bank, former
Nobel Prize winning
economist, that Stiglitz would make a fantastic Treasury Secretary. I have no idea whether he wants the job. I said it the other night when we were on a panel together at CUNY and embarrassed him. But I've been saying it at all my events because this is somebody who has been blowing the whistle on the madness of deregulation on his former colleagues at the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. He didn't just discover the dangers of deregulation last Tuesday. I think it really does take somebody with the credibility of not being invested in this economy to re-regulate it. And he has great solutions. He had a good piece in Time this week laying out, what a real exit plan would be from this financial crisis.
Someone from Wall Street versus someone from
Academia. The ivory tower.
That's
right. God forbid.
I actually think that's a coming debate because there are so many people with, personal interests and histories from Wall Street, and there's more independence in the academic economic sector. I think, especially if Obama wins the presidency, and even if McCain does, that's an actual debate that we're going to hear in Washington. Or maybe NPR international business correspondent Adam Davidson for Treasury Secretary. He was reporting on this early. All right.
Excellent.
Naomi Klein, The Shock Doctrine, The Rise of Disaster Capitalism. And is it next week that you'll have a Rolling Stone article on a lot of this called The Next Trough?
Yes, next week's Rolling Stone. It's about how they're turning the Treasury into the green zone, the Halliburtonization of the Treasury.
Naomi Klein, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC.